I'm Mike Allen, and I am the editor of a series of anthologies called Clockwork Phoenix that, for want of a better description, kind of showcase fiction that push the edges in different ways of what can be done in genre. That's one way to describe it. And last year at ReaderCon, I launched a Kickstarter to fund a fourth volume. We did three volumes through another press that went out of business. It's not my fault, I swear. We asked for $5,000 in the Kickstarter, raised $10,000, yeah, and we have a book. And we have writers who are in the book. We have seven of them at this convention. And just to additionally torture them, this is a special edition that somebody in the Kickstarter bid on and paid for $1,000 that requires the signatures of every single contributor. And guys, just so you know what you're doing, just so you know what you're doing, what I'm having everybody do is sign along the dotted lines in the table of contents.
Yeah.
And sign, place, and date on the front page of your actual story.
Place where we are right now. Yes.
Okay. And
you're half the audience.
Yes. And also sign the very back page.
Okay.
So, and I'm going to start
that
this.
$1,000 I can sign you.
I'm going to start this.
All right.
With Ken.
All right. Sign people for free. I ain't thinking.
The way I'm going to do this is I'm going to have everybody go in the order that they appear in the book. Time's sort of tight. I think we told everybody 6 or 7 minutes. Try and keep it as close to six as you can. Why don't we start with...
Can I borrow a book?
Sure. Sure. Oh, and by the way, these are for sale. They're $15 a piece. I have change. And I can also take credit cards. But we'll worry about that once it's all over. The anthology starts with Yves Maynard, so he will also start the reading.
All right. So this is called Our Lady of the Philistines. She was meant to be diurnal, yet the girl most often woke in late afternoon to a sun already declining in the sky. The worst heat of the day was fading by then, though no part of the garden was ever unbearably hot, even under the midday sun. The girl thought there must be a roof of sorts, one she could not see, but which shielded the garden from the excesses of the sun. Or perhaps part of the heat was bled into other dimensions, there to harmlessly dissipate. She understood very little about such things, and the lady vouchsafed few explanations. It was because so many of the lady's friends preferred dusk or darkness that the girl found herself usually waking so late. There was nothing she liked so much as to sit at the feet of the lady and play with her friends. There were birds who could not fly, big shaggy animals that walked very slowly as if always asleep, tiny spiky beings with short snouts and faces that remained always hidden, fat and cuddly animals that dug into the ground, and many, many other kinds. But her favorites were the stripies, not just because they were the prettiest of all the lady's friends, but because they were the ones that responded best to her love. When they appeared, they would approach the girl boldly, sniff at her hands and feet, sometimes her crotch. They suffered her to pet their thick, soft, yellow-brown fur. The smallest of them, which had a black tuft at the tip of its tail, even let her hold it in her arms and kiss it for a few minutes at a time. When the lady spoke to them, the stripies looked at her with attention, though like all the other friends, it was hard to tell if they understood anything or just responded to her voice. Sometimes, as she spoke, the stripies rose up on their hind legs, their stiff tails held behind them, keeping them in balance. The girl had given them names based on the number of dark stripes running across their back and rear haunches, 13, 16, 20. The littlest one was 17 or 18, depending on how you counted one bifurcated stripe. The girl did not see the stripies all that often. The lady had many friends, and the girl could never tell which kind she would see. And sometimes, when she went to spend time with the lady, there were no friends at all there, only the lady herself, and that meant there would be a lesson, some new words to learn, the names of the stars, the calisthenics, routines, baton twirling. On that afternoon, when the girl woke, the number of days since she had not seen the stripies had risen to 50. That was a big number, if you counted days and things of that sort. The lady would have told her it was a tiny number of seconds, stars, and atoms, because she was always making a point of correcting the girl when she could, forcing her to think about things from another side. But the girl had been growing wiser, and sometimes now she was able to argue the point. She wasn't sure, she could never be sure, but she thought the lady was pleased when that happened. And so she held on to her initial thought that 50 days without seeing the stripies was a long time, and it made her feel disappointed. And she really hoped that tonight they would be there when she went to see the lady. And in fact, if they were not, then she would take a great dare and ask the lady to call them. It had been a long, long time, far longer than 50 days, since the girl had dared to ask the lady for anything. She was too old now, the lady said, long past infancy when she could wail and beg for the nipple and incur no blame. She was growing up, and she had to fulfill her promise, said the lady, but she never would clarify what that meant. The girl had had to learn not to wish for things, to take the world as it was in all its mystery. She wondered more and more if that was true to her nature or not. The girl swung her legs down from the ledge where she slept on a pile of sere grass. On the flat rock at the far end of the cave where she lived, she found the lady had made food appear, which she did at odd intervals, supplementing the berries and nuts and roots the girl normally ate. The lady's food was as juicy as fruit, but the juice was salty, not sweet. It filled the girl's stomach wonderfully and made her feel very good. After eating that food, her ordinary diet always paled, but she could not depend on the lady's generosity to eat. That was definitely one thing she had learned not to ask for. This time, next to the pieces of food, there was also a dress. The girl usually went about naked, and whatever clothing the lady gave her felt more like an impediment than anything else. Still, if the lady had seen fit to give her a dress, the girl would wear it today. It might well please the lady. She struggled with the garment for several minutes until she'd figured out how to put it on. This was more complicated than the other dresses she'd worn. Once she had wrapped her mind around its shape, it made sense. There was a bit of rope as part of the dress just under her collarbone. Once she had put the dress on, the girl pulled on the rope and felt the garment tighten snugly around her. This was a good dress, she decided, unlike the others which flapped around her knees and made it hard for her to run. This one allowed her full freedom of movement. It almost felt as if she was naked. The color was exciting too. Her old dresses had always been white or pale yellow, while the new one was a confusion of colors, greens, browns, and grays in irregular splotches.
Steve, I believe next in line would be Nicole Cornerspace.
I'm going to read to you from a story called On the Leitmotif of the Trickster Constellation in Northern Hemispheric Star Charts, Post-Apocalypse. Now, there's a story that binds, there's a bunch of fake constellations, a story binds them together, so I don't have to give you a lot of context, I'm just going to read you a couple of constellations. For the actual story, it is now a novel, which is going to be coming out from Small Beer's YA imprint next year, and if you've seen these around, this is me. I'm reading from it tomorrow at 2 and also tonight at 9 with the Banjo Apocalypse Crinoline Troubadours. So if you're interested, please come. The Cinder Girl, area 1,119.303 square degrees, approximately 2.71%, from the sinkhole chart, razor scarring human skin, autumn. 23 stars, 8 major, 15 minor, including neither the visual binary blue supergiant representing her heart, nor the nebula colloquially known as the Spool. While this latter's representation remains the subject of some debate, it is generally agreed to be either the girl's navel or her womb. If one can use agreed in fairness, conjuring as it does more a smiling accord over a glass of fine vintage than the panting stalemate reached by brawlers, each having succumbed less to his rival's blows than to his own growing lassitude. On some charts, this constellation shares 2 major and 1 minor star with the Carrion Boy, whereas on others, the girl and boy only border upon points, for instance, the Blood Quilt chart, which depicts them handfast, or the Floodplain chart, which shows them going at each other's throats with shivs. The Lintel chart, figure 3, marks one striking departure. The two constellations are drawn together into one, torso to torso, while the star is designated elsewhere as the base of the Cinder Girl's childbed pyre. Her right knee and the carrion boy's attendant crow are here shown to represent offerings, water, bullets, seed fruit, heaped by persons unknown at their feet. The overall effect is that of a two-headed, four-armed monster god, arguably an attempt, in the spirit of the origin stories of the well before, to explain away cases of severe mutation. Apparently a light or firebringer, the Cinder Girl was, and in some few rough backwaters of the waste that was, still is, called upon with that wayworn trinity of incantation, song, and sacrifice to conjure out the sun from where it floundered in its year-long skirts of ash. In fact, whatever demarcating line is sketched in between sun and girl is vague. Most indications hint there's no line there at all. She either is the sun or else is swollen with it, as any mother is with any child. Consider then this chart, carved into the flesh from soles to brow of a girl of childbearing age, more, one who has recently born a child, but with interruptions in the chart over the girl's heart and abdomen wherein are illustrated the binary blue supergiant called the bear trap, see above, and this wool nebula respectively. These breaks in the chart demonstrate a level of artistry ratcheted up several notches from that shown in the execution of its remainder, and the entirety of the scarring was performed very shortly before the death of its recipient via living interment in the ash. The suggestion of apotheosis is not a subtle one. Pared down to its particulars, what we have in the sinkhole chart is a pair of extraordinarily well-preserved corpses, those of the above-mentioned girl and her infant, the former being illustrated with both the hallmarks of the constellation whose avatar she likely is and the chart in which that constellation may be found. The latter, we are given to conjecture, as a stand-in for the sun the cinder girl gives birth to and which is her death by immolation. It remains also a matter of supposition that the ash burial edged out the conflagration in the affections of this girl's acolyte executioners, simply because they wish the chart to be preserved. The observant eye will glean hints toward this circuit of ritual human sacrifice, for crops, for rain, for the fertility of barren wombs, from the story cycles, bones and coins, a greener grave, and cinder girl tricks the honey thief. Similar formations in other charts include the bone witch from the palimpsest chart, the chooser from the fallows chart, and the queen from the white chart. The Carrion Boy, area 487.012 square degrees, approximately 1.19%, from the Brain Pan chart, Scrimshaw Whalebone, summer. 10 stars, 4 major, 6 minor, and a further 2 to designate the eye and tail of the attendant crow toward which he is discovered making full-body placatory gestures. A random selection of charts lists the crow as either the boy's sidekick, the Holly chart, his anima, the Chalk Hills chart, his nemesis, the Gatekeeper chart, or virtually anything between. Both the Riot Shield and Blast charts, figure 4, provide striking deviations. Even the boy's posture of deference, which renders this constellation unmistakable in any sky, balanced on one foot, head down, arms up and out, hands open, palms heavy with offerings or bribes, is variously interpreted, beyond its face value, as either a game, a gambit, or a trap. More curiously still, 6 of his constellation stars belong to binary systems, 2 visual, 1 eclipsing, and as the stars shift back and forth by virtue of their mutual orbits, they completely change the shape this constellation describes upon the earthbound viewer's sky. Slowly the crow's wings shift to become the boy's, and the crow vanishes altogether. Setting aside the sheer technical achievement this chart represents, albeit carved, one suspects, with a blade not much at ease in service to the arts, still it covers in nearly microscopic detail the entire frontal bone plate of the skull of a juvenile male Ursinus orca, incidentally providing an embarrassingly large component of the bone record of a splendid creature long extinct. It appears to have served as, or been associated with, an object of some ritual significance. The skull itself was found interred in ash alongside the corpse of a young man staked down, apparently alive, to a stretch of barren, heavily irradiated slag. However, unlike what the host canvas of the sinkhole chart, see above, experienced, this was no ash burial. What covered this chart and its, what, ancillary, chaperone, was that which the winds had drifted in. One particularly intriguing aspect of this find was the presence of 9 pairs of crow's wings affixed between the stakes and their victim's flesh at wrists, elbows, knees, ankles, and neck, presumably to buoy up his manumitted soul to whatever fairer skies awaited it. Another was the assorted heap of limbs that lay atop the corpse, some crudely hacked, some removed with surgical precision, but all well-muscled and apparently quite healthy up until the very moment of subtraction. No more colorful, perhaps, than the traditions upheld in the veneration of any of these tricksters, although quite probably more grotesque and considerably more infamous, is the custom in the cult of the Carrion Boy toward ritual self-mutilation. As always, it is difficult to ascertain whether it was the custom that shaped the way of life of its practitioners, or the way of life that shaped the custom. Puzzlingly, some few seem to spring up like daisies on a slag spit, self-engendered and unreasoning. This is one of those. Owing most probably to the striking lack of sheltering features in the landscape where these people chose to settle, a large fraction of their cultural experience was warfare, preparation, avoidance, aftermath, glorification. Upon reaching physical maturity, all young men and women, with the exception of those pregnant, nursing, or convalescent, entered into a combat training regimen that only the most charitable would term rigorous. At the culmination of the training, those whose lives they had not claimed were made to choose a part of their own bodies for dedication to the Carrion Boy, in a ritual taking place under that constellation's ascendancy. The most common form this dedication took was amputation, but simple mangling of the flesh was also widely used. All these gentle ministrations were performed with the aid of song. Carrion Boy Feeds the Crows was a particular favorite, and vast quantities of scorchweed wine. One would soon have little doubt whether one's offering was deemed acceptable to the boy. Accounts still survive of bodies found turned literally inside out, bodies found tied literally into knots, bodies hanged from points quite inaccessible to human agency. See figure 5 for artist interpretation. Similar formations in other charts include the scapegoat from the stairwell chart and the juggler from the flotsam chart.
Next would be Gemma Files.
Let me just say goddamn.
That is your kind of thing, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. I'm reading from Trapweed. I'm beginning at the beginning. It begins with a quote, "For their land longing shall be sea longing, and their sea longing shall be land longing forever. An old legend of the Orkneys concerning those seals who shed their skins to become women and men." Any Selkie can be great if he fights for it when challenged. We are by no means a democracy. But for myself, I did not care to and was driven forth into deeper waters. So I swam until my fat and fur could no longer warm me, till the chill had almost breached my heart. I swam till my lungs gave out, then sank deep into darkness. When I woke, I found myself aboard ship, peltless and doubly nude. A lean man stood looking down on me, his elegant face all angles, while others watched from behind, above, so many for this creaking wooden shell to carry ocean-bound in safety. I had never seen such a number before all in one place. For we stay as far from human men as possible on Sulskari, if we can. Unless our instincts drive us otherwise, we know their works. I was gasping, painful all over, in strange places, burnt and scraped as though I'd been dragged over rocks. Indeed, my arm had a chunk torn from it, neat and triangular, nipped straight out at the point where it blended into shoulder, the same place I saw most mariners adorned with tattoo work. I gaped at this a while, and then tried to touch, and flinched from the sting of my own fingers' salt. "I wouldn't do that," the man advised without sympathy. "Call it the price of your salvation, a lesson either to keep you to shallower waters or learn to hold your breath longer when you choose not to." Though it had been quite some time since I tried for human speech, I found it returned quick enough. "Where am I, sir?" And this he smiled at, grimly enough, no surprise there, since in their hearts, most men like the pap they call courtesy, that sorry salve to their impossible pride. "This scowl the brig's mine by right of seizure," he replied, sweeping a contemptuous little bow. "Bitch of hell, some call her, or Selena Resurrecta, since she's cobbled from shipwrecks, while I myself am Jerusalem Perry, captain, a pirate, as you suspect. You were drowning, meantime, sorry sight, in one sea bread. Yet Mr. Dolomance here brang you up before mortality could quite take hold entirely. And while I misdoubt he dead you any little hurt in the performance of it as he might have, we must always recall how those he comes from are not known for their restraint in general. Mr. Dolomance? Aye, that's he, hid over yonder, where he likes it best, as you'd be dead if he hadn't found you, or if he was still able to do as he wished, instead of how I tell him to. For which you should, in either case, be grateful. Fixing with cold, pale eyes, then, like two silver pennies salt-blanched to the color of water-cured bone turned coral, and what are we to call you? You could not say it if you tried, I thought. But since I seemed compelled to answer, I rummaged for the last human name I'd heard, the one that boy I'd pulled from his boat's kin had called after him, its syllables dissolving down through the water into meaningless sound by the time they reached the cave where my sisters kept him tethered, forcing him to sire a fresh crop of younglings. What they did with him after, I never witnessed, for I was already at the sparring by then, about to choose discretion over valor, exile over family. Indeed, it only now occurred to me I might not see them again, in his company or otherwise. In that moment, I knew myself utterly alone, entirely lost amongst those who normally hate and prey on us, who either club us dead to steal our skins in error, thinking us only animals, or make away with them when we're foolish enough to leave them unguarded and detain us for their pleasure, breeding children who will never feel at home on either sea or shore, and so seeing no other way out for the time being. "You may call me Charon, sir," I said at last. To my left, I heard the thing Captain Perry called Mr. Dolomance give out with a disgusted little noise from his hidey hole, half snort, half spit, and turned abruptly, far more angry than bereft, to confront whatever creature had dragged me up onto this rotting, lurching mass of timber, held together mostly by barnacles and forward motion, at the still sore price of its snatched mouthful of flesh. I found him squatting on the weather deck, in a strange nest made from two massy coils of rope with a tarpaulin slung over top, keeping himself moist by angling into the splash from a nearby cannon port's mouth. Standing, he would be half as tall as Captain Perry, but a good two hands broader, squat yet sleek, with doll eyes and an almost lipless mouth, hiding a serrated bear trap bite. He sported what some sailors call a drowned man's pallor, close wrapped to save himself from burning in direct sunlight. It was that seabed dweller's skin of his, I later found out, which had left me so raw, drawing blood from frictive angles on the very briefest of contacts. "I know you now," I thought, meeting that lidless black gaze, if only for a moment. He well might mock, since his own kind were known to scorn names entirely. So the fact that he answered to one at all, to that mockingly polite and inexact one the captain applied to him, showed just how puissant this man's magic must be when reflected in Mr. Dolomance's grudging abeyance, his infinitely resentful loyalty, or for that matter, the mere fact of Perry being alive, having not only bent this tadpole version of a great white shark to his will, but forced it to assume a mostly human form while doing so. I have no doubt that Mr. Dolomance perceived both my terror and my pity, though his waverless gaze rejected them both. And so we stood a while, locked in mutual regard, one cold-blooded, the other warm, doomed to meet for the first time in assumed shapes, confined to this creaking hulk, me with my man-shape like a secret weakness revealed, as though I'd been forcibly shook inside out, him with his man-shape imposed from the outside in, never more than cruel illusion, for beneath it he remained all rough muscle and horrid teeth, a terrible hunger, not even held together with bones. Though we suffered the same privations, we could never be allies. I was prey to him as much as any other thing without Captain Perry's power to protect it. "Well then, gentlemen," my captor told me meanwhile, and Mr. Dolomance as well, I could tell from the begrudging liquid grumble Mr. Dolomance gave Perry back by way of a reply, "shall we retire to my cabin and speak a bit further?" And since there seemed no option but to go, I bowed my clumsy, fresh-made man head and went.
I'm reading from Lesser Creek, a love story, a ghost story. On the trestle bridge, a boy and girl stand side by side. They can just see the water through the trees. Directly below the bridge, abandoned rails curve gentle to their vanishing point. Weeds grow between the cracked ties, and two children walk, kicking stones along the track. On the bridge, the girl looks at the water. Lesser Creek. It seems familiar somehow. The greenery does its best to swallow the sparkle and shine, keeping the light at bay. But all along the bank, running parallel to the tracks, muddy paths cut through the growth and run down to the water's edge. Hoof paths, paw paths, and foot paths, carving gaps in the green. They're made for stolen sips and stolen kisses, midnight swims and midnight drownings. She remembers fireflies. Maybe it wasn't this bend in the creek, but some other. She wants to remember blue shadows between the trees and the secret wet smell of earth, bare feet trailed in cool water and luminescent bugs flashing Morse code transmissions from another world. And so she does. Who's to say her truth is wrong? It wasn't always like this, was it? Memory nags, and she asks the question, wishing she didn't have to break the silence that has stretched between them for so long. The boy beside her watches the children's dwindling figures following the rails. "Do you think we could catch them all?" he asks. For a moment, she thinks he must be talking about the fireflies she wants so badly to remember. But his past isn't her past. His memory is so otherwise and as inconsistent as hers. Who knows what meaning the creek and the rail holds for him? Side by side on the bridge, the boy and the girl are roughly the same age, 15, sliding backwards to 10 and upwards to 20, depending on who is looking. It is the age they've always been for as long as they can remember, which isn't very long. She remembers fireflies, and sometimes she remembers drowning. She looks at the boy sidewise, wondering how he died, if he died. Have they had this conversation before? She picks up a stone, weighing in a moment in her palm before letting it fly. It pings the steel, reverberating like the memory of trains. Maybe one of the children looks back at the sound, and maybe they don't. Everyone knows these woods, that bridge, these rails, that water are haunted. The girl picks up another stone, frowns, and closes it in her hand. Will we bet then? She says. This seems familiar too. Yes, a bet, the boy agrees, and a tally, on that big rock in the water. He points through the trees. She knows the stone, a big boulder planted firm in the creek's middle, dividing the current. At the end of summer, we'll count up the marks and see who wins, the boy says. A cicada drones. The sound means heat to her, summer sweat and irritation so sharp she can taste it. She shivers all the same. It won't take much for the boy to win, between the airless nights and the far worse days, the sun beating down on everything and pushing people to the edge. She bites her lip, but she's already nodding. The rails, stretching one way, lead to the horizon, and in the other they lead to a town. It nestles around a vast crossroad, and maybe for that alone, it's cursed. Could it be the town that calls them again and again, this boy and this girl in their myriad forms? Or does the town exist because they come here again and again to stand on this bridge over these rails beside that water to bet on the town's souls? The town has never borne her any love, the girl thinks. Not for the boy at her side either. She should take joy in the reaping, but she never does. There is a hunger in her, a hole deep at her core. It is her nature to wish that hole full. She isn't greedy. One soul, just one soul, ripe and sweet as the last summer peach, might last her all winter long. She looks sidelong at the boy beside her and breathes out. Deal, she says. Deal, the boy spits in his hand. The devil's own twinkle shines in his eye. They shake on it and go their separate ways. And so the summer begins.
Shira Lipkin, it is now your turn.
You don't have mercy on your souls.
My name just does not want to stay on this book.
I am reading from a story called Happy Hour of the Tooth and Claw, and Mike told me to start from the beginning. The vampire. Agony Jones walks into the bar. The werewolf. Mary Magdalene Kendall walks into the bar. The witch. I'm already in the bar. I'm in all the bars. I'm at a table facing the door, back to the wall, and I am drinking a sweet tea and not a rum and coke, because bending reality and alcohol don't mix well. Things get tangled or severed. This is where someone else might say, and then there's all the paperwork, but I don't do paperwork. I do, however, like to keep the bar tidy. The bar. The bar is every bar. The bar has always been here. It's the tavern where you meet your party. It's the saloon where all the action goes down. It's the only place on the space station worth hanging out in. I sit at a fixed point, and the bars shoot off in all directions like spokes on a rimless wheel, infinitely small slices of reality all stacked up against each other with minimal bleed through. This one has karaoke. The witch. I can work this little bit of bleed through because the vampire and werewolf bars are so similar. So similar, even, that my wardrobe is the same. I'm female in both bars, wearing tight leather pants that show off a tribal lower back tattoo where my slightly ragged black tank top rides up and back. My stomach is perfectly flat here, and my hair is long and dark. My spine feels more malleable than usual, even. It's very precise, the wardrobe in this sort of bar. Very cookie cutter. I'm designed not to stand out too much in a crowd, but this sort of bar is more homogenous than most. I doodle on my napkin in a language no one in this bar knows. Well, almost no one. The angel. The angel who tends bar goes by the name of Jack. He won't tell me his real name, which is, I suppose, perfectly reasonable. I don't do name magic, but for all he knows, I know someone who does. Jack is a cherub, not a little Renaissance puto, a for real cherub. Here we only see his man head, but he tends four bars simultaneously, and in the others I've seen his other heads, ox, lion, and eagle. He hides his wings in this bar too, but sometimes he sheds through the veil between realities, and I've found silvery feathers trodden under peanut shells. Jack does not like it when I fuck around in here. He doesn't get bored. He has four separate places to be at any given time, and that keeps him more than occupied enough. I can see everything from here, but that's so passive. The witch. I have siblings who've turned to stone from being so damn passive, from doing nothing but observing. I have siblings who've turned into stars or free-floating ideals or trees, but I'm restless. So I reach out and apply a little friction between two realities. I wear the veil just a little thin. The vampire. Agony Jones is less than 5 feet tall. She compensates with screaming red hair cut short and choppy, tall boots, and an aggressive stomp. She cases the joint as she walks in. She notes all of the exits. She's freshly fed and looks nearly human, if a bit out of date. She claims a table in the corner and watches the crowd. She winces when the beginning of karaoke night is announced. The werewolf. Mary Magdalene Kendall, all worn denim and soft black tee and long black hair, goes by Maggie or Mags. Too many Marys in her family. She walks in with a few women from her pack, laughing. She nods at Jack when she passes him, and he nods back. Mags and her pack aren't trouble. Or, well, they are, but they keep the trouble outside. Here they are model citizens whose only crime is that they hog the pool table sometimes. The angel. Jack notices that Agony and Mags are in the same bar. He is not happy. I don't think I'm getting a refill on my sweet tea. The witch. Fuck it. I lean forward, shake some salt in my hand, and sing. Very quietly, and if even Jack knows this language, I will be very surprised. And pissed off at the family lore keepers. The vampire and the werewolf. They notice each other from across the room. Agony straightens from her perpetual slouch as she watches Mags flip her long dark hair over one shoulder to make her shocked. Something ball in the corner pocket, I don't care, I don't shoot pool. Mags feels her eyes on her and looks up after the ball goes in, reflexively smiling. Agony's a solo predator, but Mags is all pack, so she feels safe enough to smile. Agony doesn't get to show anyone more than that spiky fucky persona most days. Not many people smile at Agony Jones. They're usually running and screaming. But Mags smiles. And then she smells what Agony is. She nods thoughtfully, but doesn't stop smiling. Mags turns to talk to her packmates, and Agony notices that Mags has a truly superb ass, also that she is a werewolf. Agony thinks about whether that matters. She decides that it doesn't matter a damn to her, but she doesn't know what Mags' position on that might be. And then the damn werewolves get into the karaoke. Agony would leave right now if it wasn't for Mags, because fuck karaoke. Very few people are good at karaoke, and the bar is full of people who are not those people. It is ear-assaulting shite, and Agony wishes she could still get drunk, because that might help. But the pretty wolf girl in her supple leather vest keeps looking over shyly, and no one's looked at Agony like that in a damn long time, so she waits. Her skin itches, almost. She doesn't know what this is. And then Mags gets up on stage, and Agony braces herself for her little crush to be over. And Mags busts out a perfect Jeanette Napolitano. Concrete blonde, bloodletting. The wolf girl is singing a vampire song. She is working the stage, and her hips are almost as mesmerizing as her eyes, which are on Agony. Shy little wolf girl needed a musical excuse. It's a hell of a way to say hi. Ways and means indeed. She finishes to great applause. She laughs, blushing, her eye contact with Agony a little less direct, and Agony meets her at the edge of the stage, hands jammed in her back pockets, trying to be casual. You want to get out of here? Agony says, fake cool. Karaoke sucks, present company accepted. You don't want to sing? You don't want to hear me sing. Fair enough. She laughs, her voice a little rough in the most interesting ways. I'm Mags. I'm Agony. Long story. Want to tell me about it? Agony grins, not bothering to hide her fangs, if you want. They leave the bar. It's drizzling just a little, more a mist than anything else. Miniature droplets gather like dew on Mads' long hair.
interactive exhibition of Teresa Rosenberg Latimer. I'm not reading from the very beginning, but that doesn't matter at all. Number 19, Self-Portrait with Surrogates, 1984. Oil on canvas, 51 by 77 and a quarter inches. Rhode Island School of Design Museum, Providence, Rhode Island. The first of Latimer's paintings to draw critical attention, Self-Portrait with Surrogates, portrays the notorious child abuse and murder case of the Wilson family, which dominated the Rhode Island news media at the time. 7-year-old Lisa Wilson, clad only in underwear and displaying both old scars and fresh cuts, is being beaten with an electrical extension cord wielded by her father, while her mother holds her in place. None of the figures displays any emotion. It is as if they are spectators at the event. The details, again in the hyper-realist style, closely match those of the Wilson case. The family home is accurately depicted, and the scars on Lisa Wilson's body correspond to photographs in the court file. Discussion questions. A. The composition and live-action flavor of this work resemble 18th and 19th century patriotic and polemical depictions of battles and famous events. David's The Death of Socrates, 1787, figure 5, is a clear influence. Why does Latimer employ such devices in a portrayal of domestic violence? Does it alter your perception of what you are really seeing? B. Some biographers associate the painting's title with the emotional and physical abuse Latimer herself experienced as a child. Is there anything in the picture itself to show that this is really a self-portrait? C. Does the fact that Latimer's parents were living when she painted this work alter the way you perceive it? Number 34. Magda, number 4, 1989. Oil on poplar wood, 30 by 21 inches, private collection. Sometimes called devotion by critics, this nude is the earliest extant work featuring Magda Ridley-Majeros, 1963-2023, Latimer's favorite model and later her wife. The lushness of the flesh and the rosiness of the skin are reminiscent of Renoir's paintings of Aline Charigot, C.E.G., The Large Bathers, 1887, figure 8. Latimer maintains microscopic hyperrealism even as she employs radiating brushstrokes which emanate from the model, as this Majeros is the source of reality itself. Discussion questions. The materials and dimensions of this painting duplicate those of Da Vinci's La Gioconda, circa 1503 to 1519, figure 17. Is this merely a compositional joke or homage by Latimer? How does it change the way you see the painting? B. Most biographers agree that Latimer and Majeros were already lovers by the time this work was completed. Is this apparent from the composition or technique? From the pose of the model. As you proceed through the exhibit, note similarities and differences between this and other portrayals of Majeros over the next 34 years. Number 49. Performance, 1994. Acrylic on canvas, 32 by 41 inches, National Portrait Gallery, Washington, D.C. Generally regarded as one of the outstanding memorial portraits of the 20th century, Performance is also the first painting of Latimer's highlight period, which occupied the rest of her career. Latimer was fascinated by the restoration of the Sistine Chapel ceiling, 1980-1994, which sharply enhanced the clarity and brightness of Michelangelo's colors. Although some still doubt whether the restoration reflected the artist's intentions, Latimer was most interested in the side-by-side contrast between the pre- and post-restoration appearance of the frescoes. See before and after pictures of the creation of Adam, figures 11 and 12. In one of her diaries, she wrote, quote, "They stripped away the hurts and filth of five centuries and released the purity within. It's like looking at one of the Platonic forms. Beneath the battered, mundane person, the person we see in everyday life, is the true person, the soul maybe, or the heart. Of course it looks less real to us. We're so used to the violence and degradation imposed on us by the world that we're unprepared for ourselves without it. How did I miss this before? Maybe I wasn't ready till now to understand it. But after what happened, what's still happening, this is the perfect tool, maybe the only tool," end quote. After 1994, nearly all of Latimer's paintings feature one or more highlight figures, people in a painting whose coloration has the clarity and brightness of the restored Sistine Chapel frescoes as contrasted with the duller, more commonplace tones of everything else in the composition. They seem out of place and fantastical, even cartoonish, and yet Latimer employed the same level of microscopic detail in her highlight figures as to their surroundings. The first critics who saw performance misunderstood Latimer's introduction of highlight figures because the painting is set on the stage of the Providence Performing Arts Center, and the central figure is the artist's recently deceased friend, the singer Pamela Enoch. Because she appears on the stage as if she were performing a concert, Enoch's heightened colors were taken at the time to represent the effect of theatrical spotlights. Arthur Mallory's review called the lighting sentimental in an otherwise naturalistic work, noting that true spotlights would have enhanced the colors of the surrounding stage as well. Magda Majeros is visible in the front row, the only member of the audience. She is turned in her seat to face the artist. Majeros is not portrayed as a highlight figure, but in the same comparatively muted tones as the theater. Discussion questions. A. As you view the many highlight figures in the remaining paintings in this exhibit, consider whether those figures seem more or less real to you than those painted in ordinary colors. Why? B. Critics and biographers have puzzled over Latimer's words, what's happened, what's still happening, which seem to refer to the event or events that inspired or impelled her to adopt the highlight style. But what events were they, and how did they lead to this change? C. Not until 2025 did Latimer paint Magda Rita Majeros as a highlight figure. Usually she appears in ordinary tones, as here, why is this so? D. Why does Majeros wear a puzzled expression? Number 59, Critique, 1997. Acrylic on canvas, 44 by 67 inches, Davison Arts Center, Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Latimer painted this piece to commemorate the addition of her self-portrait with surrogates, number 19, to the permanent collection of the RISD Museum. The setting is the contemporary artist's gallery of the museum. Self-portrait with surrogates hangs at the center of the composition, with adjacent works also visible, notably Intelligentsia, 1986, by her friend and classmate J.J. Kramer. In the foreground is the child, Lisa Wilson, the subject of self-portrait with surrogates, painted as a highlight figure. The young girl is presented as if she were a critical viewer of self-portrait with surrogates. She is turned three quarters toward the artist, but her left hand is raised toward the painting in a dismissive gesture. Her face is wry and full of humor. She appears to like the artist, even if she does not think much of the painting. Discussion questions. How do you interpret Lisa Wilson's apparent attitude towards Latimer's earlier painting? Is Latimer ridiculing her own work? B. Why is Lisa Wilson portrayed as younger than she was in self-portrait with surrogates? Why, without visible evidence of abuse? What is the significance of the party dress she wears? Stop.
And Barbara Krasnoff has the last story in the book and is also the last reader. I didn't leave anybody out, did I?
No.
Okay, good.
This is from the History of Soul 2065. It is not, it's part of the first part, but it's not the very beginning. Because the living room was so crowded, everyone had to sidle around the table in order to get to the dining room, which, because it was actually used as a sort of a library, was nearly empty of furniture, and so had space for people to stand and chat. Rachel took the Haggadah, and she and Annie made their way to a corner and started to page through the book. But they lost interest quickly, and Rachel started describing the adults in the room to Annie in a careful whisper. That man over there, the one with the beard, that's Abram, an old friend of Uncle Mark's. They were both in high school together. He's bossy, Annie observed, and he interrupts all the time. Rachel shrugged. I don't like him, she said, but Mom says it's not polite to say so. She pointed surreptitiously at a stout, smiling young woman who was talking to Abram. That's Yolanda, Aunt Susan's best friend. She brought a pineapple for dessert. She's studying to be a minister and used to live in Namibia. Uncle Mark came into the kitchen with a quick stride, holding a thin brown bottle and thrust it at Abram. Here, he said irritably, kosher enough for you? Oh, hi, Eileen. Glad you brought Rachel and Annie, is it? With you this year. He kissed his sister on the cheek and ruffled Rachel's hair. Hi, Uncle Mark, said Rachel. It's raining. Really hard. Annie added, unwilling to be left out of the conversation. Of course it is, said Uncle Mark. God forbid we should have good weather on a holiday. Abram, who appeared not to mind Uncle Mark's tone, was examining the bottle carefully. I don't see anything problematic, he said. The reason I had a problem with the glaze you used last year was the corn syrup. Things need to be kosher for Passover. This from a man who has milk in his coffee with his hamburger, said Uncle Mark, addressing the room at large. He grabbed the bottle back and returned to the kitchen. Time to start, Aunt Susan said loudly, and everyone wandered into the living room and began to sit at the table. So, I was looking for something to watch the other day, Abram said as he started opening a bottle of wine, and I stopped at a channel where a writer, a rabbi I think, was talking about a legend in which there were originally only 600,000 souls in the universe. At some point after the creation, each soul broke into many pieces, which means that we are all actually made up of a piece of a soul. And when all the pieces of that soul find each other, part of the universe is healed and made whole. Yolanda looked thoughtful. How many pieces were in each soul originally? Abram shrugged. I missed that part of it, he said, handing her the bottle. Some say that each soul was made up of two parts. And when a man and a woman find each other and marry, that is the entire soul. There is also some argument as to whether the souls truly blend during life or after death. But as with everything, it's all a matter of interpretation. Yolanda handed the bottle to Aunt Susan, who poured some for herself and Uncle Mark and then passed it to Rachel's mother. Here, she said, reaching across the table to another bottle, we brought some grape juice for the girls. She poured generous helpings into their wine cups. Suppose that we're all part of an original soul, Yolanda said, leaning across the table. Is it possible that by coming together tonight, we are helping to heal the universe? Would that include all of us? I don't see why not, Susan said. After all, in this presumably enlightened age, we can assume that whatever fractured soul is involved, all the pieces aren't necessarily Jewish. Here, it's going to be a while before we eat. And she broke a large flat matzah into two pieces and handed them to the girls. Abram's finger came up, a sure indication that he was going into lecture mode. Actually, he said, most rabbis would probably argue that the legends only refer to Jewish souls. Not that they aren't saying that the other souls aren't valuable, with a nod toward Yolanda, but they aren't part of the Jewish mythos. I'm not Jewish, said Annie, distressed. Can't I be part? Of course you can, Annie, said Yolanda, frowning at Abram. There is room enough for everyone. How many? Asked Rachel, carefully biting her matzah into a circular pattern. How many what? Yolanda asked, puzzled. Rooms in heaven, said Rachel, and the two girls giggled. 652 and a half, said Uncle Mark, sitting down. The half is a bathroom, which everyone has to line up for each morning. The girls broke up, and Susan blew a kiss at her husband. You know, maybe it's more like a union, Uncle Mark continued. That would make us all official members of, say, Soul 2065. Does our union have a good health plan? Asked Yolanda. Rachel's mom smiled. Maybe we should have t-shirts. Member of Soul 2065, or hats. Can I have one? Asked Rachel, immediately perking up at the idea of a present. Then she suddenly remembered, even if I get the four questions wrong? Of course, Aunt Susan said, and you won't get them wrong. I promise, even if you make a mistake, just pretend you did it on purpose, and everyone will believe you did it right. That's what actresses do. Really? Rachel brightened. Really? Aunt Susan grinned. She stood and tapped her wine glass with her knife. I hereby declare that this meeting of Soul 2065 is called to order. She sat down. Now, let's start the Seder.
So much, folks. That went great. If you want to know how the rest of the stories go, here are copies. They are $15, or you can get them at the small beer press table or wherever you see me. If you want to hear me read, at 5:30, I will be reading a sample from my very first novel, The Black Fire Concerto, released this weekend. So I hope to see some of you there. Yes, there will be. Yes, we will have what, lime tarts
and strawberry rhubarb tarts, yeah. And fresh fruit.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, folks, so much for that great reading.